let me get this straight. If the indictment is... if the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas.
We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. We're in the midst of a golden age for superhero-themed cinema right now. In addition to recent big-screen adaptations of the X-Men and the Hulk, next month's Spider-Man 3 will mark the completion of the critically acclaimed trilogy starring the Marvel Comics web-slinger. DC Comics has resurrected the Batman and Superman franchises in recent years as well, and there are slews of additional superhero films in production all throughout the Hollywood pipeline. Why are we now seeing a resurgence of interest in these classic characters? And what types of growing pains have superhero tales, in both theaters and television, had to endure prior to the current upswing? My guest is pop culture critic Leonard Pierce, whose writing can be found at lunakid.com.
Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Under this garb, we're perfectly ordinary Americans.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. Today on the show, we're talking about the resurgence of superhero fiction in film and television. And my guest, back once again, is freelance writer and pop culture critic Leonard Pierce. And welcome to the show again, Leonard.
Thank you. It's good to be back. We haven't talked in a while. So.
It's been a while. You were here in Chicago, then you were in Minnesota. Now you're down in San Antonio, I believe.
Yep, that's correct. And, you've picked... My pet topic for today.
Leonard has a website, lunakid.com, and also he's the senior editor of the Hi Hat Pop Culture online magazine, and that's found at thehihat.com. He's written many times about superhero fiction and the portrayal of superheroes in film and television. And these are great times to be a costume crime fighter in Hollywood. We have Spider-Man 3 coming out early next month, and that will mark the 14th Marvel Comics film adaptation over the last decade. And DC Comics has seen the resurrection of both the Batman and the Superman franchises in recent years as well. We have Iron Man coming out. We have apparently Luke Cage, directed by John Singleton, which I am very much looking forward to seeing in the next year or so. So film critics have obviously pointed to the fact that advances in CGI technology have made the portrayal of superhuman feats and superhuman combat so much easier today than in the days of Christopher Reeve Superman films. But Leonard, are there any other factors at work here? What's really coming into play in terms of the resurgence of superhero fiction?
Absolutely, there are other factors at play. For one thing, there's a much bigger audience than there used to be for superhero fiction. Comics themselves have gotten more mature and more adult, and so have their audiences. The problem with superhero films for the longest time was that, like superhero comics, they were directed at children, and so the quality was never expected to be any good and was never any good. But as comics audiences have matured, have gotten older, you know, the demographic for an average superhero comics fan these days is somebody in their mid-20s to early 30s, so has the expectation of the quality of the films increased. And in addition, and I can't overestimate this at all, you know, it's just it's such a huge factor, is that the people making superhero films for the first time are people who grew up reading superhero comics. the people who are directing, who are writing these films, and, you know, with the case of Nicolas Cage, who played Ghost Rider, who are even starring in these films, were people who grew up reading comics and have a genuine affection for the art form. Whereas in previous years, you know, up until the 70s, the people who made these films were generally Hollywood people, and they were taking on the assignment of making superhero films more or less as a mercenary endeavor. The studio called them up and said, hey, we want to make this movie about Captain Marvel or about whoever, and they said, all right, you know, and they approached it in a very workmanlike way. They didn't know anything about the character, about the comics universe, about the aspects of the comic that made it special to its fans. And nowadays, you have people making films who are really affectionate towards the medium and who sort of go out of their way to at least attempt to make it right.
What were the monumental comics that really transformed the audience, that comics could appeal to adults as opposed to just younger kids?
Well, the sea change in the comics world came in the early 60s with Marvel Comics. Stan Lee, who was their editor and who wrote almost all of their stuff at the time, he sort of took a gamble that the age of the comics fan had increased. You know, they didn't have a lot of demographic research back then the way they do now, but he sort of played a hunch that the people reading comics were no longer children. They were adolescents, mid to late teenagers, sort of what we think of today as the archetypical comic book geek. And so he tailored his writing towards that demographic. He introduced elements like in Spider-Man, of Spider-Man being a sort of nerdy teenager who transformed into this heroic figure, and the Fantastic Four being a dysfunctional family who attained superpowers. And that stuff really hit home for its readers. It turned out he was exactly right about who was reading comics. Then in the 70s, there was a similar sea change at DC Comics when a lot of writers, especially Denny O'Neill and a few others, started writing more realistic issues into their comics. You know, there was a key period there when O'Neill was writing both Batman and Green Lantern and Green Arrow, where he brought in stories of drug abuse, of racism, you know, of what were at the time hot-button social issues. And by the end of the 1970s, comics had really developed themselves into an art form that appealed to an older, you know, even post-adolescent audience. And I think it's no coincidence that that period, the late 70s, was also the time at which you started to, for the first time, see films and television shows like Superman and The Hulk that, you know, really tried to make a serious film, or at least a commercially successful, non-children-oriented film out of superhero comics.
Why do you think it took Marvel so much longer to break into cinema? We had the Superman films back in the late 70s. We had the Batman movies starting in the late 80s. But not really until, Blade in the late 90s, but that's not really considered one of the main Marvel characters. But we didn't have, until the X-Men in 2000, we didn't have traditional Marvel characters seen on screen.
Well, I actually, I wrote an article about this for the Hi-Hat some time ago, for the first issue, in fact. And I think it's a combination of factors. I think it's it partly took that long for a big enough audience to develop. It took that long for filmmakers and screenwriters to come along who had developed that affection for the material so that they could really make a well-written and well-made film about it. And as you mentioned, you know, that was the point at which CGI technology developed to the point where you could present this sort of thing on screen and not have it look ridiculous. You know, the tagline for the first Superman movie was, "You will believe a man can fly." But if you look at it compared to today's films, you don't believe a man can fly at all. It actually looks, it's very awkward and, you know, kind of hokey looking compared to what we can do today. So, it's really kind of a confluence of a number of factors that all just sort of came together in the late 90s. And since then, they've just been coming thick and fast now that they have both the technology and the audience combined with filmmakers who want to do it and who are excited about doing it.
You mentioned the Incredible Hulk TV show that debuted in the late 70s with Bill Bixby and also with Lou Ferrigno. And I was interested to read the show. The premise, or at least the idea that they'd have this television show about the Hulk, actually predated Superman. And if you watch the show today, I mean, I don't know what your thoughts are, but it seems incredibly dated. You have the Hulk fighting against low-level goons with guns. There are no other superpowered characters. And really, television is about talking, and the Hulk show is about, well, Bill Bixby's anguish, his pain over the crimes or the destruction that this creature causes. And you didn't really get any of the Hulk action that you'd see in the comic books. But what were your thoughts on the original Hulk TV series?
Well, it came out at an interesting time. 1978 was when it debuted on American television, and that's also the same year that the first Superman movie came out, and it's the same year that there was a Doctor Strange TV movie that is very little seen today, but was actually pretty good. It was sort of a banner year, no pun intended, for superhero movies. The Hulk show, it got some things very right. I mean, part of the key to the Hulk character is that it really is a tragic story about this decent man who wants to do well, but he's got a monster living in him who's always causing all sorts of destruction, and he can never really have any peace. And I think the show succeeded in portraying that to an extent, but, you know, it's also a story that played itself out in a superhero universe, and a lot of what makes the Hulk comic succeed is that he's up against other monsters, he's up against supervillains, he's in sort of a science fiction-y milieu. And, you know, just having him fight, you know, as you say, hired goons and petty criminals and things like that, it doesn't work. It distracts you from, you know, you're thinking, well, here's the strongest creature on the planet, and he's, you know, doing what he does every episode, which is, you know, throws a bunch of tires around a crook so the crook can't get away. And it doesn't succeed in that respect. And, but, you know, they had a good lead. I think Bill Bixby did a good job as Banner. But because of who they cast as the Hulk, you know, Lou Ferrigno, who looked like the Hulk, but, you know, he had hearing problems and he couldn't speak very well, so they decided to have the Hulk not speak. You lost a lot of the charm of the Hulk comics of that period, where the Hulk spoke sort of like a, you know, a dim-witted child. And
always in the third person, right?
Right, yeah, Hulk Smash, you know, and he always had the cute nicknames for everybody, you know, because he couldn't remember their names. And, you know, that was a lot of the appeal, at least when I was a kid growing up reading the Hulk comics, of, you know, of the Hulk's character at the time, and that was all lost in the TV show. So it didn't particularly succeed that well. And, you know, interestingly enough, when they made the Hulk film in, you know, a few years ago, when Ang Lee made the Hulk film, which I think was good in many ways, but overall kind of unsuccessful, it was largely for the same reason. You know, they picked an unmemorable villain. They introduced him in a very, you know, almost a too subtle way, you know, that sort of confused the audience. They also chose to make the Hulk a largely non-speaking role, except for at one point in what turns out to be a dream sequence. So it was more successful in the way it looked and the way it was framed. You know, the whole comic book framing device, I think, worked well. But in a lot of really basic ways, it didn't succeed.
You mentioned the Doctor Strange film also as well. We had a live-action Spider-Man series, and I think CBS was very concerned about being known as the superhero network back then.
Yeah, back then, because there was this sort of wave of superhero films and TV shows coming out at the time. You know, that's no longer an issue, obviously, you know, given the audience for things like that. That's another thing that I think has sort of changed. As I mentioned before, is that the studios are a little more confident that there's an audience for this sort of thing now. And, you know, you don't see any studio quailing from the idea of producing a superhero movie now that they know it's going to make money. And back then, there was by no means a guarantee that that would happen. And so a lot of the studios and the networks treated it as a big gamble, like, well, you know, what kind of reputation are we going to get if we do a film like this or a TV show like this?
You also mentioned briefly the Ang Lee Hulk film that came out back in 2003, I believe. And you're right, it didn't do very well, got a lot of mixed critical reaction. I enjoyed the film. Even though there wasn't that fantastic villain, I guess, for the Hulk to battle against, you did see him kind of wreaking havoc on the military. And I enjoyed the fact that it was a more subtle look. I am happy to see that they are going to make a sequel, right? It's called The Incredible Hulk. I believe it's coming out scheduled for 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And but how about, let's take a step back here and take a look at superheroes in television before the Hulk, before the Richard Donner Superman films. What were we looking at there?
Well, you had, you know, of course, the Amazing Spider-Man series in the 70s, which is around the same time, I believe. And it was sunk largely by the fact that it had bad scripts and bad performances. It tried as well as it might, but it was typical of the product of the pre-1980s superhero approach insofar as it was made by people who clearly didn't care about Spider-Man, didn't know anything about Spider-Man, and didn't want to make the thing anything other than a sort of childish action show. You have the same problem with the Linda Carter Wonder Woman show, which was around the same time, which, you know, again, you had sort of a winning performance by Linda Carter. You know, the show made her into a big star. But the show itself is, today, it's completely unwatchable. It's hokey and campy, and it suffered from the, you know, the problem of the 1960s Batman TV show, which was that it was nothing but camp. That works if that's what you're looking for, but most sincere fans of comics hate that sort of thing. And so they were really disappointed by bringing that approach to Wonder Woman and especially to Batman, who by that time had progressed into sort of a darker, more sinister character.
Amazingly enough, I'd completely forgotten about the Adam West Batman show, and I grew up watching that in syndication, you know, every day.
By far the single most successful television show ever about superheroes. But, you know, in terms of its critical appeal, very disastrous. You know, it made a lot of money, very popular, you know, had a huge audience for its time, spawned a lot of sequels. You know, of course, you had the Green Hornet, which was sort of a knockoff of it, and then you had the Wonder Woman show, which was influenced by it. But the critics hated it, and it even arguably set back the world of comics quite a bit, too, because while it was very popular, the comics writers and editors said, oh, well, let's start copying that approach. And so the Batman comic, which was, you know, before that fairly well written, started to become extremely campy and hokey, just like the TV show. It set off a period of really badly written Batman stories, and even Marvel comics, which Batman was a DC character, but even Marvel for a while, which had the reputation of being the non-campy, more adult alternative to DC, started carrying a little banner on their books for several years that said a Marvel pop art production to sort of tie it in to that whole hokey campy approach.
And the amazing thing is with that old Batman show is you had big name talent. You had Burgess Meredith. You had Vincent Price appearing on the show. Mm-hmm. Also, you're talking about camp, and I think that's something that certainly happened with the Superman film series.
Yeah, the first one especially, and to a certain degree the second one. There was still, at that time, the notion that these things could not really be approached as anything but camp. And the reason for that is because, again, there was still this perception that their audience was largely children and that there was not an understanding that they had a built-in audience of genuine fans who wanted to see the material approached respectfully. There were still not filmmakers who themselves really appreciated the material. And so the thought was, well, if we're going to make this approachable for mainstream audiences, we're going to have to camp it up. We're going to have to sort of wink at them and let them know it's a joke and say, oh, yeah, this is what you think comics are. That's what this is. And similarly, it was for a very long time, and you even still sort of see it, although not so much anymore, but well into the 90s, anytime there would be an article in the mainstream press about comics growing up and how there were a lot of adult comics and, you know, ones with strong sexual themes or, you know, a lot of violent material or a very adult storytelling approach. Even when The Watchmen came out, which to this day is considered one of the better comics ever written, you know, the article would always say, Biff, Bam, Pow, Sock, you know, comics are growing up. And it would always sort of make a reference to that hokey old Batman TV show approach. So, you know, again, as popular as it was and as much money as it made, it really had a disastrous effect on the quality of the material being made and the ability of comics to be treated seriously. So.
Oh, yeah, in terms of the reputation, I mean, I grew up on comics, and reading them in the late 80s, you'd have adults everywhere kind of rolling their eyes. What are you doing reading comics? What are you wasting your time on? And this stuff is really well written.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And, you know, that's still a problem today, but again, because there are enough talented people involved, And, you know, there are legitimate filmmakers who want to take their shot at making comic book films that are respectful of the material. That's starting to change a little bit, so that's a good thing. But, I mean, when you think about the first superhero comics, you start back with Superman and Batman in 1938. You know, it's taken 70 years to attain that kind of respectability, which is far too long.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and today I'm joined by Leonard Pierce, and we're talking about superhero fiction in film and television, how it's evolved over the years, how it's contrasted with actual comics that have been written over that same period of time. Also, something that I want to go over, you mentioned the Watchmen comics in the mid-80s, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit later, because that they're talking about making film, finally, on the Watchmen series. But the Dark Knight comics, the Frank Miller comics that came out in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. Now, the Batman films, certainly the first one, the Tim Burton film with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson, was that a direct response to the popularity, to the more adult nature of the Frank Miller Batman comic books?
No, I don't think it was. The first Batman film, the Tim Burton one, was in the works before Frank Miller's seminal Batman books, which would be Batman Year One and The Dark Knight Returns, before those came out. You know, it didn't get made until sometime after, but there had been scripts floating around for a while. And there was a general intention to make a more serious Batman film. But, you know, looking at them today, with the exception of sort of the visual elements of the film, you can't really read Batman Year One or The Dark Knight Returns and get much of a sense of it from watching the Batman movie. You know, they're definitely two adult approaches to the material, but they're fairly divergent. They're not ones that really coincide at many points. You know, now when Christopher Nolan made Batman Begins, that, I think, was much more influenced by Dark Knight and especially by Batman Year One, although rumors continue to circulate that there's going to be an actual Batman Year One film made one of these days. Just in terms of the dialogue, the approach to the character, and things like that, the first Batman movie was really highly anticipated at the time because the character is such a classic, you know, American fictional character. And even less so than Superman, there had been nothing on screen or on television that approached it in a way that would appeal to fans of the comic. You know, the Batman TV show we talked about, but it really wasn't anything that fans of the comic recognized as being their Batman. And so when it came out, it was very highly anticipated, but looking at it today, I don't really think of it as particularly successful. The best thing about it, I think, was Jack Nicholson's performance as the Joker. But, the casting of Michael Keaton as Batman still seems to be pretty awkward to me. And the presence of Kim Basinger just seemed more like a distraction than anything else. So when I actually wrote this piece for the Hi-Hat about comic book films, this was some time ago. I think it was around 2002 when I wrote it. And I mentioned then that we still didn't know if Hollywood was capable of making a good Batman movie. Since then, Batman Begins has come out, and I think that actually was quite good for what it was. So I guess Hollywood can make a good Batman movie, but it remains to be seen whether it can make more than one.
You mentioned before that superhero films are being made now by directors and by actors who are actually fans of the comic books, and I think that's certainly something that came into play with Tim Burton, right? Because I don't believe that Tim Burton was very familiar with the character through the comic books. And
he wanted to take quite a lot of liberties with the character, and the same thing when he was being discussed as a possible director of the Superman Returns movie. And I don't know whether this is because he doesn't know much about the character or whether he just has his own very particular ideas about what the character should be. But, yeah, any time the advance news of what he intends for the characters comes out, fans usually react pretty negatively to it.
Yeah, his vision of Superman was that, if I'm correct, that Superman would wear some kind of costume that would give him his power, sort of like Iron Man. It's like, you know, if you want to make that kind of story, then make your story, but just don't call it Superman. Why do you have to have the mythology?
You know, I think liberties can be taken with, with the characters and still make it a pretty respectful creation. You know, I remember fans of Spider-Man sort of going nuts when the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man film came out because word had gotten out in advance that he meant to make Spider-Man's webbing part of his powers, you know, that they just sort of came out of his hands. And in the comics, of course, it's a gadget. It's a little device that he invented that would shoot this webbing. And a lot of the fans sort of went nuts, and they said, oh, he's playing with the character too much, he's changing him too much. And then, of course, you know, the movies were just so well done and so well received that everybody forgot about that. So I don't think it's, you know, necessarily the case that you can't take substantial liberties with the character, but fans are really sensitive to getting the feel of the character right. And so you can change a lot of the details, but if you change the essence of the character, that's when they'll really sort of lash out at you, I think.
In terms of getting back to the Batman films, we had Michael Keaton play the role for a couple films. Then we had Val Kilmer. We had also George Clooney pick up the mantle of Batman. And why is it possible to do multiple Batmans with different actors, whereas it's not possible to have someone else play Indiana Jones and take Harrison Ford's role?
I think it has something to do with the fact that Indiana Jones was a creation of film. You know, there was one Indiana Jones, and he was made for a film. We didn't even know he existed until that. And so when he first showed up on film, we instantly associated him with Harrison Ford. And to put someone else in that role would seem very jarring. Whereas Batman had an existence before the Batman films, and people are willing to accept anyone in the role as long as they think that the portrayal is correct. It's the same thing with Superman. You know, there had been other Supermans before Christopher Reeve, and there are going to be other Supermans after Christopher Reeve. Obviously, there already have been. So I think maybe a closer analogy is James Bond. You know, there was a James Bond in the minds of a lot of people before the first Dr. No film came out. You know, a lot of people had read the books, and a lot of people had a conception of the character. And since there are so many James Bond stories, and there are so many Batman stories and Superman stories, it's sort of an eternal character, and people are more willing to accept the fact that eventually one actor who played him is going to get older, and there's going to have to be somebody else to step in and play the character because the character endures. Whereas, you know, with Indiana Jones or with Rocky or somebody like that, we only have a conception of them from the films, and we're not really willing to take him out of that continuity and say, well, let's stick somebody else in there and keep it going. It's much more unique to the medium of film, and so you don't have an existence of that character outside of the film that you can rely on.
Join us in 2 weeks, on April 25th, for the conclusion of our discussion on the resurgence of superhero fiction in film and television. Once again, my guest has been Leonard Pierce, whose writing can be found at www.ludikid.com. That's ludickid.com. My name is Kevin Fulham, and for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. Again, that's undersurveillance.org.
Four against one.
Four against two, Batman!
Robin,
I couldn't resist. You were taken in by her, but I'm too young for that sort of thing.